The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I am Dick Hayden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sports Illustrated for Kids. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the January-February issue of Sports Illustrated Kids, and perhaps from other sources as well. We're still waiting for the next issue to show up, but we have some items we haven't covered yet in the issue that I noted. So let us begin. We're going to continue reading from The Science of Sports. And one of the first items we have up is one of those continuing ones from Bill Nye, the science guy, and it is on climate change. Bill Nye on sports, how sports, rather, could reduce their carbon footprint. I think the biggest way sports leagues contribute to climate change is all the travel, he said. So I would encourage sports leagues to come up with ways for people to play and travel a little less. If you produce carbon dioxide because your car burns a lot of gasoline compared with another car, you should pay more taxes. And then that money would go into a fund and we would redistribute it, and we'd give back to everybody the way Alaska redistributes the money it gets from its oil and gas reserves. So this would be a big idea. We'd incentivize sports teams to travel less. And if you want to get into it, we'd make helmets and pads and clothing out of recycled material. And we would reuse and reuse them. Polyester can be melted down and made into more plastic. There's an interesting idea. Next up, out of epidemiology, COVID questions. Dr. Celine Grounder, epidemiologist with the United States COVID-19 Task Force, answered our questions about sports and the pandemic. SIK, how much longer will it be before kids get back to normal for kids? Kids will start probably need to be wearing masks for a while, I would say definitely through this school year. Then it's possible they will still have to be wearing them next fall. SIK, is it safe for kids to play sports right now? It's really a question of if it's a team sport and if it's a contact sport. For example, tennis is pretty safe if it's outdoors. But something like football is going to be an issue, even if it is outdoors, because you're still getting into pretty close proximity. And it's not just about the sport itself, but all the activities around it. Are you in a locker room? Are you lifting weights? Maybe it's just celebrating after the game. Those things can be risky. And SIK asks, should kids expect this kind of situation again in their lifetimes? Dr. Grounder says they should definitely expect more epidemics and pandemics. They may not be as severe as this one. What we are seeing is that these infectious diseases are emerging at a faster pace, and that is a combination of population density, proximity with wildlife, and climate change. All of those things are increasing the probability of something jumping over from an animal reservoir to humans. Some of those will propagate and become pandemics or epidemics. Under the heading of Futurism, it's titled Hear Us Out. Back in July, in our Rebooting Sports issue, we made some semi-serious suggestions for how sports could come back, not just differently, but better. We weren't trying to predict the future, but we can't help but notice that at least one of our ideas came to pass. Adam Silver, if you've read SI Kids, can you give us a shout-out? With no crowd noise, player dialogue became a focal point of broadcasts, which was on our wish list. If that isn't just a mundane coincidence, and they did steal our idea, we would like to reiterate a few more suggestions from that issue. NHL mascots as goalies, tiny soccer fields, and paintball football. Thank you. Okay, next up, containment. Did the bubble affect home court advantage? Scientific experiments often involve a control group in which one variable factor, altered in the experimental group is unaltered for the sake of comparison. For many years, sports had plenty of data on how teams performed within their home stadiums, but it never had a true control group. One team was typically at home. Neutral site games were few and far between until the pandemic. The entire NHL and NBA playoffs happened in the same stadiums. It was not a perfectly designed scientific study. Teams were still designated either home or away, and the home team was allowed to pipe in familiar musical cues, fake crowd noise, and partisan cheers. But important elements of home field advantage were missing: familiarity with the stadium, nearby family, and adoring fans. In the bubble, the road team had a record of 43-40 in the playoffs. In 2019, the home teams won 46 to the away team's 36. It's an interesting result, but there's only one responsible scientific conclusion. More data is needed. You know, kids, history doesn't always be something that you learn about in class. There's a section here in SI Kids titled History, and within it, The Trailblazer is the title of the article. Kurt Flood was a great center fielder, but that's not why his enshrinement in Cooperstown is overdue. Believe it or not, there was a time when free agency did not exist in sports. Up until the 1970s, the various major leagues in the United States operated with reserve clauses, which basically gave teams their players' rights indefinitely. A player could not switch teams unless their current employer granted them an unconditional release or traded them. Of course, the owners liked this system. It allowed them to hold on to their best players forever. But it punished these players, who had no ability to live where they wanted to leave a bad situation or negotiate for better pay elsewhere. In 1969, St. Louis Cardinals center fielder Kurt Flood challenged the reserve clause, in effect giving up his own career to improve that of every other athlete since. A native of Oakland, California, Flood began his baseball career in Cincinnati, where he signed right out of high school in 1956. In addition to free agency, his career also predated the amateur draft, which began in 1965. Flood's early career was difficult. When the Reds would travel in the South, he suffered the racism of Jim Crow laws. In one instance, he was barred from his team's own clubhouse, which meant that he had to change into his uniform in a tin shed. He played rarely for the Reds before they traded him to St. Louis in 1957. However, once there, Flood would establish himself as one of the best center fielders in baseball. In 12 seasons with the Cardinals, Flood batted .293, won 7 Gold Glove awards, and made 3 All-Star teams. He helped the Cardinals to the World Series titles in 1964 and 1967, and finished in the top 20 of MVP voting for 5 consecutive seasons from 64 to 68. A 1968 Sports Illustrated cover declared him baseball's best center fielder, a title he took over from Willie Mays. The do-it-all outfielder was even an accomplished painter. By wins above replacement, Flood remains the 9th most valuable Cardinal of all time, ahead of players like Lou Brock, Yadier Molina, and Jim Edmonds. But his career in St. Louis ended unceremoniously and, thanks to the reserve clause, not on Flood's terms. Flood was to be part of a 1969 blockbuster trade that sent him and 3 teammates to the Philadelphia Phillies for 3 players, including star third baseman Dick Allen. Flood found out about the trade from a reporter. Flood quickly indicated his intention to hold out. It was not unusual for veteran players to hold out in that era of baseball, since it was the only means they had to force teams to give them a raise. But Flood's motivation went beyond a mere negotiation. Dick Allen had asked out of Philadelphia because of the fans and the organization's racist treatment of him as a black player. That reputation, combined with his principled objections to a system that moves players against their wills, led him to sue Major League Baseball to challenge the reserve clause. Player trades are commonplace. The usual aspect of this one was that I refused to accept it. Flood would later write in his book, The Way It Is. It violated the logic and integrity of my existence. I was not a consignment of goods. I was a man, the rightful proprietor of my own person and my own talents. Supporting Flood in his lawsuit was Marvin Miller, head of the Major League Baseball Players Association. Miller had taken over the MLBPA in 1966 with aspirations of changing the backward way teams traded players. Flood's lawsuit represented the perfect opportunity to strike at the heart of an unfair league. But Miller warned Flood the most likely outcome of his case was Flood's never being offered a job in baseball ever again. He would likely lose the case and lose his livelihood. But the publicity it would generate had the potential to start a movement in sports. The Phillies tried to entice the center fielder with money, but Flood went ahead with his lawsuit. He sued Major League Baseball and Commissioner Bowie Kuhn for $1 million and the right to become a free agent under antitrust laws. Antitrust laws exist to encourage competition between businesses and discourage monopolies. Major League Baseball had a long-standing antitrust exemption. Despite his fighting for their rights, active players did not show public support for Flood, with a few stars even denouncing the lawsuit. Jackie Robinson, however, and fellow Hall of Famer Hank Greenberg testified on Flood's behalf. Flood sat out the 1970 season as his lawsuit progressed. The judge ruled against Flood. He returned to baseball in 1971, out of shape, and quit after just 13 games. In 1972, the Supreme Court of the United States agreed to hear his appeal. In a 5-3 ruling, the Supreme Court upheld the lower court's ruling in Flood v. Kuhn. Even though he lost his case, Kirk Flood's courage showed the unfairness of the reserve clause and inspired players to fight for a better system. Over the next few years, the MLBPA became more powerful. In 1975, an arbitrator named Peter Seitz would rule that players who sat without signing a contract for 1 year were no longer under team control, granting free agency rights to pitchers Andy Messersmith and Dave McNally, and ending the reserve clause. From a tickle, a flood. Kurt Flood died in 1997 at the age of 59. He lived long enough, however, to address the players of the Major League Baseball before their 1994 landmark strike. They gave him a standing ovation. Marvin Miller was finally enshrined in the Baseball Hall of Fame in 2020 for his role in ending the reserve clause and revolutionizing labor relations in sports. Flood, however, still remains underappreciated for his sacrifice. Last February, 102 members of the U.S. Congress sent a letter to Cooperstown urging the institution to induct Flood. Even as his family waits for recognition, his legacy is apparent, from the Milwaukee Bucks wildcat strike against police violence last season to the ongoing fights between players' associations and owners. Whenever players fight for a better situation for themselves and others, they do so in the shadow of Kurt Flood. It makes one think that there is a real point behind Kurt Flood's action. Namely, we are all equal and deserving of equal treatment. Next article up is Deft, D-E-F-T, with the left. Deft with the left. In school, favoring your left hand can mean getting a pencil markings on your pinky. In sports, it's a much bigger deal. Well, what do we have here? The Michael Jordan of the Mirror. On August the 2nd, 2020, James Harden had 24 points in a 120-116 win over the Bucks. It was an inefficient performance, 5-14. But it gave him 20,796 career points, which passed David Robinson for 39th all-time in scoring. It also put him first all-time in left-handed scoring. Does that make him the greatest left-handed player of all time? Technically, no. LeBron James is left-handed, except when he plays basketball. He shoots righty because he emulated Michael Jordan as a kid. Ironically, one of Jordan's most iconic shots was a lefty layup in the 1991 finals against the Lakers. Here's a little personal story. It's not in the book. It's about me. I am right-handed, except when it comes to... I am left-handed, except when it comes to throwing. I cannot throw a ball with my left hand worth a hoot. I can throw a ball with my right hand perfectly. I don't write with my left hand. I write with my right hand. But I'm dominantly left with everything else that I do. Kind of crazy, isn't it? But it does show something. Whether you're right-handed or left-handed, if you've got the talent to do something, just do it. Do it the way it feels. Okay, continuing on with this article, it's kind of interesting. Pride of the Lefties. Legend has it that right-handed movie star Gary Cooper played Lou Gehrig in the Pride of the Yankees film by having the film flipped in editing. The theory has since been debunked by Tom Schreiber of the Baseball Hall of Fame. The Iron Horse himself had some experience playing baseball with his other hand. When Gehrig was a child, his German father, Heinrich, gave him a catcher's mitt that went on his left hand, since Gehrig was a lefty, not realizing baseball players throw with their dominant hands. I got to tell you, though, it didn't hurt Lou Gehrig. He came out okay. Southpaws on the northern border. In 2019 and 20, 324 lefty shooters played in the NHL alongside 192 righties. Wow, that ratio varies widely when broken out by country, even within North America. Americans often shoot with the right hand, like Jack Eichel, while Canadians tend to shoot with the left hand, like Connor McDavid. Canada isn't a magical land full of lefties where the toilet flushes in the other direction. They just prefer to place the dominant hand higher up on the stick for better stick handling. Okay. Lefty with a catch. Handiness has a bearing, no pun intended, when you play on the baseball diamond. In 2017, after Chris Bryant got hit by a pitch, Cubs first baseman Anthony Rizzo became the first southpaw to spend an inning at third base in 20 years. Jack Clements, who retired in 1900, is the only full-time left-handed catcher ever. That just never happened. Batters bias, the top four hitters of all time, by OPS, I'm not sure what that is, are southpaws. Kershaw stands alone among the top pitchers by ERA. The five greatest hitters of all time are Babe Ruth, left hand, Ted Williams, left hand, Barry Bonds, left hand, Lou Gehrig, left hand, and Mike Trout, right hand. The five greatest pitchers of all time by ERA, Mariano Rivera, right hand, Clayton Kershaw, left hand, Pedro Martinez, right hand, Jacob DeGrom, and I don't know him, right hand, and Jim Devlin, right hand. I mean, I don't know any of these people personally, but I didn't know about that particular one. And sports figures nicknamed Lefty, well, they're ranked as 1 through 6. Steve Carlton, Randy Johnson passed him for all-time lefty strikeouts. But Johnson was nicknamed the big unit. Lefty Grove is number 2. Lefty Drizel, number 3. Phil Mickelson is number 4. And outside of golf, this is odd. Outside of golf, he is naturally right-handed. But he learned to play golf by copying his right-handed father, hence the mirrored approach. Interesting. Number 5, Lou Tendler. And number 6, Lefty Gomez. Okay. I think now we're going to go to what if, and this is a little bit of football work here. Okay. What if the best college team played the worst NFL team? So what do you think would happen? Okay, well, let's see what they say in this article. Every once in a while, maybe more often recently than ever before, there comes such a terrible NFL team that an age-old question emerges. Can the best college team beat the NFL's worst team? Well, this happened in 2016 with the Cleveland Browns, and in 2017 with, again, the Cleveland Browns. In 2014, it was the two-win Tennessee Titans, and in 2007, the 1-15 Miami Dolphins. This year, a new team has recharged that question, the New York Jets. The Jets are bad. Their average margin of defeat in the first 13 games, all losses, was more than 16 points. Five of those losses were by at least 20 points. They fired their defensive coordinator during the season. They benched their quarterback. So what if they played the Alabama Crimson Tide? Bama is as strong in college as the Jets are weak in the pros. Nick Saban's team just completed one of the most spectacular regular seasons in the sport's history, winning every game by at least 15 points with an average margin of 32.7 points. What better year to stage a showdown? Well, let's do it. Bah, humbug. An actual matchup would be illegal on many fronts. Also, it might not be such an enjoyable game, according to industry experts. The common thought among experts, both in college football and the NFL, is that even the worst pro team would not just beat the best college team, but would trounce them. Back in 2016, when the hapless Browns were stumbling each week and Saban's Crimson Tide were dominating the college game for yet another year, longtime odds maker Danny Sheridan set a betting line on that mythical game, and the Browns were 27-point favorites. If you're shocked, don't be. An NFL team employs a 53-man roster that is filled with, by definition, NFL players. The best college teams may have, at best, 15 players who could crack an NFL roster. Not everyone feels this way, though. In a story that ran in Sports Illustrated in 2018, former Jaguars and Bills defensive tackle Marcell Dareus, an ex-Alabama player himself, estimated that the strongest tied teams could scratch out at least a few wins in the NFL season. "We'd beat teams because they would make more mistakes than Alabama," Dareus said. "We may not be as physical, but other teams would make mistakes. We would not." Certainly, there are some players who can step right into the NFL and compete. Last year, quarterback Kyler Murray left a very good program, Oklahoma, for a mediocre NFL team, the Cardinals. He promptly threw for 3,722 yards and rushed for another 544. But while some of college football's best skilled position guys are prepared to make an immediate impact at the NFL level, those on the offensive and defensive lines often enter the league with years of development still left ahead of them before they are good enough to play, let alone start. Think of it this way. NFL teams are made up of the best college players. College teams are made up of three groups, a small handful of players who at the moment might be ready for the NFL. Another small group who, with years of development, could play in the NFL, and a much larger group who will never play professionally. It is hard to win in this league. Even the worst team has the best players from every college. Former Alabama and current Ravens running back Mark Ingram told SI in 2018. Consider some of the best college players and their early pro careers. Take, for instance, Ingram himself. Like Murray, he won the Heisman Trophy as college football's best all-around player in 2009. But Ingram didn't have his first 1,000-yard rushing season until his sixth year in the NFL. He had more yards in his sophomore season at Alabama, 1,658, than he had in his first three seasons in the league, despite playing more than twice as many games. His average per carry was a full 2 yards fewer, too. In 2016, the online sports simulations company WhatIfSports.com ran numbers and generated a result for a story published on NFL.com. Over the course of 1,001 games, the beleaguered Browns would beat Alabama 94% of the time, and the average score was 33-14. But if it's the Jets, you might say, they're terrible. Well, let's look at some of those Jets players. Quarterback Sam Darnold, while struggling at the pro level, smoked opponents in college at USC, passing for 7,229 yards and 57 touchdowns to 22 interceptions. The team's top receiver, Jamison Crowder, set the ACC record for catches in a season while at Duke. Defensive tackle Quinnen Williams was a unanimous All-America and Outland Trophy winner at Alabama. You get the picture? You put them on an NFL field together with a pro-caliber talent, and their Jets still can't lead their team to a win. So just think how they'd fare playing alongside lesser talent, no matter how fun it is to think a college team could at least beat a bad pro squad. There's very little chance of it happening. That's, in a way, a little bit of a disappointment. But on the other hand, I think it's structured so that's the way it probably should be. We're coming down toward the end of the program, so let's take a look at some of these what we call baseball cards or trading cards. Danielle Kang, K-A-N-G, of the LPGA Tour. What do we know about her? Well, she's 5 feet 6 inches tall. She's born October 20th in 1992, and her hometown is San Francisco, California. Thanks to back-to-back wins, the fourth and fifth of her career in August, Kang was second on the LPGA money list and first in the season point standing as of December the 7th. She is a two-time U.S. amateur champ, and her first victory as a pro was in a major, the 2017 LPGA Championship. Did you know Kang qualified for the 2007 Women's U.S. Open? When she was 14 years of age, the youngest player to qualify for the Open was an 11-year-old, Lucy Lee, L-I, in 2014. And another one is Domantas Sabonis, Indiana Pacers basketball forward, height 6'11", weight 240 pounds, born May the 3rd, 1996, Portland, Oregon is his hometown. In his fifth season, Sabonis made his first All-Star team in 2020. He averaged 18.5 points and 12.4 rebounds, fifth in the league for the season, and had 4 triple-doubles. And with that, we come to the end of our program. We've run out of time for today's episode of Sports Illustrated for Kids. We hope that you have enjoyed it. I'm Dick Hayden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and the content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sports Illustrated Kids is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, how about giving us a call at 919-832-5138, 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and be sure to listen next time.